equity in research, and ultimately healthcare itself. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving, and remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today is Rachel and Stephen. Yes, that's right. We do not have another guest on our show today. We did have a plan for a guest, and unfortunately that fell through. So you're stuck with the two of us for the next half hour or so. Hopefully we'll talk about some things that are interesting. We're sort of going off script today, and we'll see how that goes. And, you know, let us know what you think. Rachel, I thought we would start out by just talking a little bit about our own backgrounds, how we became teachers. So are you good with starting with your story?
Sure. I am a second grade teacher, and I started as a paraprofessional in the classroom. So I worked with students with disabilities, and I took a break from working in the classroom after a couple of years. Eventually went back and got my teaching degree and started off as a special education teacher in middle school, learning center teacher. Mm-hmm. And then moved for a year to fifth grade, and then second grade I've been at for going on 11 years now.
11 years with second graders, okay.
Yeah, which is not exactly where I thought I'd end up. I thought I would stay middle school, but sometimes, you know, this in profession, you don't always know where you're going to land.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I've been really lucky to have a great team to collaborate with, and I think that in large part has kept me really happy at the school I'm at. And now I have a administrator who's very supportive and great to work for. So
nice.
Scary to think about changing your job and not knowing what to expect from your administrator. That's such
a huge
impact.
Yep.
Your life, your career.
Absolutely.
How about you?
I started teaching swim lessons when I was 16 years old and loved working with kids. So I think that probably planted the seed for wanting to do more of that. Plus, I also think that, I mean, don't most kids at some point wonder or have the thought cross their mind about being a teacher, because they're in the classrooms and they're dealing with teachers. So I think especially if they have a teacher that they like, I'll bet the thought crosses their mind, right? As opposed to a lot of other careers that maybe they never come across or experience in their life, at least as a child. But I think that's kind of where it started. I really enjoyed my sixth grade teacher. I still remember the day that I cracked some kind of a joke. I wasn't, you know, always a class clown, but I was sometimes, you know, say something that would disrupt the class a little bit. And I said something, I don't remember what it was, and he had me stay after class. And I was a little nervous because that wasn't something that I normally had to do. And, or after school, really, because of, you know, sixth grade. And he said, okay, you know, see that dictionary over there? I want you to go and look up the word impertinent. And I went, and I'll never forget what the definition of impertinent was. And that was all I had to do. And he said, all right, I'll see you tomorrow. So I think those are, you know, the teaching swim lessons and my sixth grade experience kind of planted the seed for me. I grew up in California. I went to UC Santa Barbara. I majored in psychology. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with a bachelor's in psychology. I worked in a group home for a while. And then I thought, well, you know, I like teaching. I also like coaching, because swimming and water polo were my things in high school. So I thought, oh, I could coach and teach. So I went back to school and got a teaching certificate, and I taught math in California, middle school math, for a couple of years, even though I was not a math major. And then that was when I learned about school counselors, because I hadn't really had much interaction with school counselors, you know, as a student. And I thought, huh, okay, I have a psychology background and I like working in schools. School counselor sounds like the perfect fit for me. Now, if I can only escape Southern California, I'll be happy. So I applied to schools in the Northwest. I ended up going to Seattle U and getting my master's in counseling, became a school counselor, moved to Portland like 20 years ago, continued to work as a school counselor, coached water polo. And then a story for another day, got myself into some good troublemaking that eventually pushed me out of that job, and really was kind of blacklisted, I think, because of my administrators. You know, you talk about administrators, it's so important that you work with administrators that are supportive, because if you work with ones that aren't, they can really make it hard for you to get your next job, because they're the ones that get called, even if you have good references from other folks. So I went back to school and got my special education endorsement, and now I teach special education at Reynolds High School.
Epic journey.
Yeah.
You know, I remember wanting to work with kids in my 20s, and I was one of the first class of AmeriCorps. I was the first class of AmeriCorps volunteers. Uh-huh. And I worked for the I Have a Dream Foundation. And so I worked in school at Vernon, actually, for 2 years, working in the classroom as support, but also doing after school and summer programming. And I just, for many, many years, wanted to work with kids, but I did not want to work in the public school system because I felt like it was just a system that was not a joyful learning experience for a lot of people. And full of kind of rules and structure that I felt was not really conducive to human development, I guess.
Yeah.
And so it took me a very long time. I didn't get my teaching credentials until I was 37. So I resisted, and then I found that I could create my own environment in my classroom, and I could also work to create change in my own school, in my school district, and education in general. So it was a long road to get there, with a lot of hesitancy on my part, but
yeah.
Now I'm glad I'm here.
You're still glad you're here?
Well, for the most part.
Okay.
In some ways.
Yes. All right. So we have a couple of topics that we wanted to touch on in our conversation today. First being COVID. So what are some of your thoughts on returning to school given the state of this country on COVID?
You know, honestly, I feel pretty bleak about our country's response to COVID. I think we all can agree that now it's not about eradicating COVID, it's about learning to live with it. And I guess we're fairly lucky in Portland metro area that I think for the most part people believe in masks and vaccinations. Maybe I'm fooling myself, but I like to think that. But I think for a lot of the state, a lot of the country, I can't imagine being a teacher in Texas, or where they're actually outwardly saying you cannot require masks.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a death sentence for teachers and students. It's beyond comprehension. So at least I know that having watched the last school board meeting, I don't know how this is going to look on the ground. Usually it doesn't end up looking that great, but at least they are talking about the Delta variant as if it's a real thing and something to be concerned about. So I'm happy that there are mask mandates, but I just worry that we're entering this phase where we're accepting the fact that we're going to let people die.
Yeah. When you think about worst case scenario going back into schools this year, what do you see as potentially worst case scenario?
Well, I know that there's been no talk of having smaller class sizes. So I know we're going to be cramming lots of bodies into small rooms, which, to me is appalling for a couple of reasons. One, for obvious public health reasons, but also, with all the talk, I don't agree with this idea of learning loss, but with all the talk of learning loss, to then cram the same huge class sizes together instead of having smaller groups where teachers can, really get to know and have a lot of more like one-on-one and intentional kind of support for individual students is beyond me. But I've heard no talk of smaller class sizes. It's like, wow, we had this opportunity to really rethink how we were going to do things and really think about what, pandemic or not, best supports kids in their learning and both academically and social emotionally. And, nothing's changed except for we have a very, very noisy air filter in our room that you can't turn up all the way because it's too loud to hear each other talk.
Yeah, I feel some disappointment too about not having used this opportunity to really I mean, since we really had to stop what we were doing, it seemed like a natural place to really re-examine how we do education. And I feel like other than some additional uses of technology that we didn't have before, that we didn't use before, that we're sort of going back, being pressured to go back to just doing what we did before. And I'm also curious, what do you think of the idea of mandating vaccines?
I mean, we already do. we have requirements for attending school for vaccines, you know? So I don't know why this is any different. The elementary age kids are not able to get this vaccine. So,
yeah.
I mean, at the very least, like, those are the classrooms, you know, if you're not going to mandate vaccines, I don't know. I feel like you should. I read that, you know, offering people money to take the vaccine versus saying you aren't going to be allowed to have this job or go to this place unless you have it, the threat of being excluded from your job or places you want to go has a much higher rate of people being vaccinated than offering them money or just begging them, you know?
That makes sense.
So I just heard about New York that's going to have a passport, and if you want to go indoor dining, plays, anywhere that's like fun and inside, you have to have a proof of vaccination.
There's a coalition forming of I think they're mostly bars at this point in Portland, I know, that are doing that. What do you think about testing, about maybe mandating periodic rapid testing of all students and staff?
I mean, in, you know, there's all this stuff that's ideal world, right? But do I have faith that that could ever happen? No, not in this country. We've proven no. So yeah, it would be great to have access to rapid testing and to do regular periodic testing, but we don't even have enough staff to have decent class sizes. How are we gonna pay for that? You know, we already don't pay. There's so many things that we don't claim to not have money for.
Right. So, and yet we have all this additional COVID money. So you'd think that we could use some of that to, you know, hire some health officials or whoever, could even be a, you know, private company, just to come in and do some testing, especially, you know, beginning, maybe even if it was once a quarter, it seems like it'd be something that could be done. But I hear what you're saying as far as mandating it at a large scale, like state or national level. Yeah, I think that would be tough, but I could see maybe it wouldn't be too hard of a lift for a school district, an individual district with the board that was supportive of that idea to pass something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're gonna do regular testing, it should be like fairly regular, you know, like once a week or something. If you're really trying to stay on top of community spread, and I just don't see us developing that capacity, at least not in Portland.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you work in elementary school, I work at high school level, so your concerns about your students might be different than mine. Of course, your students won't be vaccinated at all. Mine will maybe be, maybe two-thirds of them, if we're lucky, will be vaccinated. But I worry too about the ones that did not engage with distance learning at all and are coming back, or the ones that, you know, occasionally engage but didn't earn credit, especially at the high school level. You know, one of the focuses is on earning enough credit to graduate, right? The numbers have to add up. Mm-hmm. And so there are all these students now that are not on track to graduate, right? Whether they are sophomores, juniors, or seniors, there are a whole lot more students that are behind in credits. So not to mention, you know, learning, you use the term learning loss. Of course, that's another topic, but I'm just thinking about just the sheer credit numbers and wondering how we're going to get students caught up.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, for my coming into this next year, I'll have students who have been in a school building for half of kindergarten. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a real, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of work around building community and sharing space and
how to sit quietly at your desk with your hands folded and how to line up and
but you know, it is going to be a shock to the system, I think. If you know, I mean, one of the great things that about distance learning, there weren't a lot, but is the ability for kids to move and be active, bounce around. You know, I had kids just like flying all over their room, but they were still engaged and listening and participating, you know. And they're going to have to stay, you know, in their area. I mean, it's not about sitting perfectly still with your hands folded, but no. It's not going to be the free range of movement, I imagine, that it was in the past.
Yeah.
So, you know, being a person that likes to have a lot of choice about where you are in the room and having little nooks and rugs and places to sit and, like, kids being able to sit together and work together, like, that's going to be a completely different scenario. And so there's just so many things. I don't know what it's really going to look like and the kind of challenges we're going to have to face just in terms of community building. But, you know, we were able to do it over distance learning. And then the kids that did come back in the classroom at the end of the year, they were actually, I think, so happy just to be back together that being in their little zone around their desk wasn't like that much of an ask because they were just glad to be there. But a whole year of not having that sort of ease of movement for young kids in the classroom, I just don't know what that's going to be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your typical class size is what?
Typically 28, 29.
Yeah, that's just not right. I mean, that's just not even morally right to just cram that many little second graders into a room with one teacher and expect, you know, sort of ideal learning to be going on. But we don't have a whole lot more time, and I want to talk a little bit about the anti-CRT critical race theory attacks that are happening on educators. And no, we aren't, for the most part, teaching critical race theory. You know, it might be taught occasionally in a high school level class, but what are your initial thoughts? We just have a few more minutes, but what are your initial thoughts or response to these attacks that have sprung up since last spring, I think?
Yeah, I see it as, you know, it's like AstroTurf, part of the whole agenda to privatize education, attack public education, attack teacher unions. I mean, if you you know, any kind of investigating, and it quickly pivots to, you know, get rid of teacher unions, get school vouchers. You know, I mean, it's all part of the same conversation. So I don't think it's very real or authentic critique. I mean, I think it is in the way that, like, right-leaning, right-wing people who are really dedicated to whiteness and white privilege and white supremacy feel threatened by the changing world, and so they're grasping at straws to try to beat back any of the changes that are happening, and they're going to continue to happen. And, you know, it's a sinking ship, and they're just desperate to keep hold.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to differentiate between, you know, just the average person who has been, you know, misled or drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, and but really has, you know, been losing out in this system and is and can feel that something is wrong, that things aren't right, right? That they're having a harder and harder time making ends meet or being able to, you know, afford a house and all those kinds of things. But then they're being misguided. They're being, you know, because the folks that really have it have a lot of power and wealth and want to keep things the way they are. They don't want a united front against them, right? They don't want, and they certainly don't want people to realize that the system is rigged by things, including systemic racism. So they don't want that kind of thing taught. You know, they don't want kids to learn about systemic racism because that says that our systems aren't fair. So I think it's important to differentiate, though, between just the average, you know, follower who, you know, maybe shows up and yells at a school board meeting or something, and these people that have a lot of money and power that are, you know, funding these AstroTurf groups that you talk about and pushing for this, because the last thing that they want is a united group of, you know, working class and poor white folks and people of color united and realizing that the system is rigged against them.
I agree that there's a difference, especially when it comes to power and wealth, but I also think it's a choice to embrace racism and just struggling being white or working class does not mean that you can be led down this dark path of, you know, everyone else is the enemy. It's the immigrants. It's, you know, Black people getting whatever scholarships or whatever they want to say that, like, sort of says that it's them, the white people, against everyone else. You know, that is a choice. That is a belief system that you have to willingly follow through on. So, you know, people who are screaming about CRT and don't want their kids to learn about real history, especially that entails, like, the history of people of color in this country, they're choosing to be openly racist.
Yeah. And I'll just say that, you know, critical race theory at this point, it's not a theory. I mean, it's based on history. It's based on the truth. So we have, really, we only have about a minute left. So just real quickly, maybe name one or two things you are looking forward to this school year.
Well, I do.
Or are you looking forward to anything this
school year? I'm trying to stay somewhat positive. I did enjoy being in person with the kids again. So I'm excited about that. I am actually excited that I've always taught social emotional skills and community building, but I feel like there's more space and acknowledgement of how important that is. And so I'm glad that people have, you know, people at the top making top-down decisions have realized that that's important.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say for me too. I'm looking forward to seeing students in my classrooms and being able to see their faces, at least most of their face, the part that's not covered. And yeah, I love my students, and that'll be a treat to be able to have them back in my class. And then I'm also just looking forward to continuing to fight for justice through my union work, and also outside of my unions. I feel like, I feel like this could be a good year for us there.
Right on. I feel the same way. All right. Thank you, Stephen, for talking with me and joining me on KBOO. Thanks to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.